are going to explore the educational promise of video games. We hear so much about the potential negative effects of video games. Do they also have educational benefits? Good morning, I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8 minutes past 6 o'clock on this Wednesday, December 18th. We will talk with two guests about how video games can help us learn and how they are being used in classrooms. And we'll welcome your questions and maybe your concerns at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Are you into gaming? Do you have some favorite games, and do you think they've taught you anything? Are you the parent of children who love playing video games? What questions do you have to our guests about the educational impact of video games? Let me welcome our guests. Very happy to have with us Constance Steinkuhler, Associate Professor in Digital Media at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, co-director of the Games Learning Society Center. From 2011 to 2012, she served as Senior Policy Analyst in the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy, where she advised on national initiatives related to games for impact. Good morning.
Good morning.
And Kurt Squire is also with us. He's a professor of digital media in the Department of Curriculum Instruction at UW-Madison and co-director of the Games Learning Society Center in the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy.
First off, Kurt, what is the Games Learning Society Center?
So it's a group of about four or five faculty and maybe 20 graduate students and undergraduates and game developers who are doing research and development into the future of learning with interactive technologies, particularly games.
Mm-hmm. And Constance, researching the educational impact of these games?
Absolutely. I mean, we run the gamut from creating games for impact that are designed to be educational or elicit behavior change from players, all the way over to studying what kids are doing in the commercial game space.
Yeah. So, Constance, there is evidence that we can learn from video games.
Absolutely, yes. I mean, you know, it's a lot like talking about television. It's hard to talk about it in the abstract unless you talk about, well, what are you actually playing or what are you actually watching? So content certainly matters. But the truth of the matter is that, you know, video games are the one single medium that can convert screen time into activity time. And that makes them a really provocative medium for learning.
Let's talk a little bit how popular video games are right now. Kurt, how big is this industry?
Well, Constance, you're probably more familiar with the most recent numbers than I am on that, actually.
Yeah, they're shocking. Well, at least for non-gamers, they're shocking. So let me give you a little bit of an idea of scope. So if you look at trade organization numbers from even 2010, you start to see that total consumer spending on games is about $25.1 billion. Now, that number, you know, it's hard to sort of put your head around what that number means. So if you compare it to something like the music industry or movie box office movies, you find that video games dwarf those industries. Video games at $25.1 billion compared to music industry, which is about $15 billion, or the movie box office movies at about $10.5. So, you know, if you're like me or if your listeners are like me, when I was in high school and throughout college and even now, you know, a large way that I socialized, a large way that kids found similar other children and adults to socialize with was really through music or through the love of movies and film. Well, now it's games. Games are the primary medium for a youth audience. And those numbers are only increasing over time. They're certainly one of the fastest growing industries in the U.S. economy. So again, here's just another number to put in our back pocket. You know, from like 2005 to 2010, the entire GDP grew by about 16%. In comparison, the games industry revenue more than doubled. So it is a significantly large entertainment industry, and it's only getting bigger.
Yeah, it's really stunning. What makes video games so compelling?
Well, there's a lot of features, and like Constance said, it's really hard to talk outside of any particular one, but it's factors like the fact that people have control or agency over what happens on screen, competition, both with oneself and with others. More and more, though, you're also seeing cooperation and collaboration. It's a way that people and families play together. I play a lot with our sons. If you look at a lot of the research, particularly as we get into mobile and social games, as a way of informal getting together or connecting is a big factor as well. And then there's kind of fantasy and curiosity. The story, many games have interactive stories and so on. But a big one really is, I guess, that's interesting in, as it relates to learning, is that games are really a series of problem-solving activities. So oftentimes we will play a game until we get bored with it, and that is when we've kind of solved its problems or it stops being an interesting thing. So that's one of the things I think that makes it a really interesting medium for learning.
When did both of you start seeing gaming as an educational opportunity?
Well, Kurt, I mean, Kurt was really one of the first people who wrote a full PhD on video games, and I think really had to sort of fight to get a thesis on gameplay through. From my end, I really started somewhere around 2002, 2003. And I'll be honest, you know, I was not at all a gamer. The last time I had gamed was in arcades in the mall, right? And as a teenager, you know, this was probably like right in those beginning teen years. I think I was at the arcade more to socialize with friends and to meet boys than really play the games, although I have to say I do rock Ms. Pac-Man, Galaga, and a few other classics. And to this day, I still rock them. But, you know, I had not played games for a very, very long time, and I went to grad school trying to understand. I'm very interested in how people learn from each other and how does socializing and sort of the social interaction, how do people construct knowledge? How do they solve problems together? And I was working on projects where we were creating these sort of chat room type environments that were quite serious and then asking people to go and do tasks in them. And we could show that people would learn something, but we really had to almost bribe them with grades or money or something to get anyone to go in these spaces so we could study it. And I started thinking about it, and I thought, you know, I would like to study. It's very hard to study what people are capable of doing, what the possibilities of cognition online are, if you're working in a space where no one wants to be. So I decided, you know what, let me go out and try and take a look at some natural environments to see what does it look like when people actually are enjoying what they're doing and what they're, you know, sort of considering online volunteer spaces. And that was the first time I logged into a game. I spent 2 weeks with my avatar stuck on the same level, pounding at my keyboard, incredibly frustrated because they're very hard. And then slowly the game, I started to sort of see what people were doing in this space. And the kind of games I study are these massively multiplayer online games. And the moment I really sort of started taking seriously the activities they were doing there, I was absolutely blown away. I mean, the level of complication and sophistication of what people were doing for play and paying to do and calling entertainment was far beyond anything I would have ever asked of them in the lab. So I immediately dropped all of my previous plans and said I'm going to study this exclusively from here on out. And that was, I've been studying them ever since.
I have to admit, I probably, the last time I played a video game was Ms. Pac-Man. I'm not sure. But what about you, Kurt?
Well, for me, I grew up as a kid playing, well, things like, you know, Strat-O-Matic football and board games, but then in Atari, and then kind of never, like a lot of kids my age, I'm also in my 40s, switched to computers and started programming my own kind of games. And as I started growing up with games, got interested in, you know, what does it mean for people who grew up playing things like SimCity, which is now, you know, 25 years old, Sid Meier's Civilization, and all of Sid Meier's games. He makes a lot of historical games. And just got really interested in what does it mean to learn, say, history through a strategy game, or if that's your primary entree, say, as opposed to learning it as a narrative. And from there, I actually had a similar story to Constance's where I was doing kind of immersive VR 3D stuff and started thinking that, you know, these technologies are fine, but they're not nearly as immersive as my PlayStation, right? And it's the techniques that they use as designers, the way that, you know, challenges are constructed or stories are done or, you know, competitions managed that is immersive. So then I got really interested in studying games as kind of both as an architecture for engagement and then also as, you know, potentially a way to learn. Because it just struck me in grad school, if we had things like SimCity, well, maybe we could make some that were maybe not quite as entertaining, but would end up being more, even more educational in the way that, say, documentary film is, to use an analogy. So from there, I started studying things like Civilization, kind of popular games that have themes and content that relate to things like history, to understand what people were learning out of them. And then I've been designing games for learning more or less for the last 10 years or so.
We are talking about video games and learning, and we're welcoming your questions. Does your family play video games together? What games do you love the most, and what do you think you're learning from those games? 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. We are talking with two guests who are video game experts, the educational role of video games. Kurt Squire is a professor of digital media in the Department of Curriculum Instruction at UW-Madison, co-director of the Games Learning Society Center in the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery, and Constance Steinkuhler, associate professor in digital media at UW-Madison and co-director of the Games Learning Society Center. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. The video game industry is booming. 58% of Americans play video games, and last year, consumers spent more than $20 billion on the hobby. With so much time and money invested into gaming, could video screens become the new classroom? We are talking with guest gaming experts and exploring the educational promise of video games. And we're welcoming your questions and your concerns and your experiences. Are you or are your children into gaming? Do you see an educational component? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Let's take some calls. We have Tracy in La Crosse with us. Hello, Tracy.
Hi, Joy. How are you today?
Good. Do you have? I see you have a son who plays video games.
Yes. Well, I have three sons, actually, but my 17-year-old was born premature, and from the time he was kindergarten through fourth grade, we could not help him to understand how to read at all. We tried every tool the schools gave us, and then his older brothers introduced him to online gaming, and he was forced then to be able to read and forced then to be able to type. So he types 113 words a minute now without error. Well, okay, some error, but not much. And, you know, he still has a problem getting anything from his head to a pen to a paper, but it opened a whole new world for him.
Well, can you give us an idea of what kinds of games he plays, Tracy?
He likes to play World of Warcraft. There's new ones out called League of Legends that he plays with his brothers. And it's just those kinds of PC console role-playing games, RPGs.
Yeah, thanks, Tracy. Well, Kurt, what can video gamers learn how to read and type on video games?
Constance, you can go ahead with that one.
Tracy, what a great story. I mean, it's a great and compelling example. You know, for the last several years, I've been studying actually explicitly teenage boys in particular and reading around games. And it turns out that games are really very powerful literacy intervention in many ways. And if you start to look at sort of the level of text, the reading level of text that are involved in games like World of Warcraft, the reading level is actually right around high school graduation, which is, you know, much harder than what we would even expect out of, say, a newspaper or a news magazine like Newsweek or a Sports Illustrated magazine. So the reading level is quite high, and the, you know, what's interesting about the text and reading and writing around something like World of Warcraft is that, it's not just text that the companies produce that kids are reading. It's also text and manuals and fiction and nonfiction that the players themselves are producing. So it's this real culture of writing and reading is something that people do together as part and parcel of socializing and playing. And that makes it a really powerful intervention. We ran an after-school program, to give you an example. We ran an after-school program for teenage boys, about 25 guys, ranging from about 12 to 17, and we studied them for a period of a year trying to understand, really, you know, if games are this powerful of a medium, why are boys still reading on average two grades below level in school? Because that's our national average. So I wanted to sort of unpack this question a bit. So we studied 25 boys over a year to see how are games caught up in their other sort of schoolwork, et cetera. And when we started comparing their reading around school-related material versus their reading around game-related material, on the game-related material, I could show that so-called struggling readers in school were reading up to 8 grades above their head, and that they were reading with near-perfect comprehension. And when you unpack why, a lot of it has to do with the fact that they care enough to be persistent in the face of challenges when it comes to reading text that's difficult. So if you step back from all that detail and think for a minute, what you start to see is a pattern where game-related reading in particular, although I would imagine it might extrapolate to other forms of fandom spaces, but game-related reading by comparison becomes a world in which you have a high-level text with academic vocabulary that kids are engaged enough to be reading and persist when they hit challenges like difficult academic words, which, you know, as a literacy nerd, I have to say it, you know, it starts to feel like a perfect storm for reading.
You know, I'm familiar a little bit with World of Warcraft in that I had a nephew who met a girlfriend playing this online. She lived in a different community, and I don't understand exactly how this works, and maybe a lot of our listeners don't either. How does, Kurt, how does one play World of Warcraft?
Sure. So it's a game called a massively multiplayer game. So the idea is that there's the game itself actually lives on a server somewhere, in this case in kind of Los Angeles, and then people log in from wherever they are in the world and then play together in a shared kind of fantasy space. So there are thousands and thousands of players online all day. So it's kind of a living, breathing world that just exists 24/7. So right now there are hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of players kind of logged in. And they're very interesting spaces for a lot of reasons. One of the big ones is that, and this is, again, a reason I actually went to games, is that they're in many ways the heir to the kind of the fantasy of virtual reality. So if you remember, you know, going back 10 or 20 years ago, we'd say, oh, you know, there's going to be this world where everyone kind of logs in and, you know, thinking like science fiction. And it's really come to pass, and it's come through video games, weirdly. So, you know, this is a place where there are things like online economies where the gold and money that you earn in a virtual world actually has real-world value. So it's bought and sold, you know, in places like eBay and other gold exchanges. So you might think of it a little bit as like a fantasy-themed virtual reality. And as we get an explosion of devices like tablets and phones, you're seeing this kind of morph into other kinds of, you know, interesting fantasy worlds where people can be online and have a persistent identity that you know, exists solely within this sort of fantasy game space.
Well, I have other questions about that, but we also have other callers. So let's go to Drew in La Crosse. Hello, Drew.
Hi. First off, I've been gaming since as long as I can remember. I started off with games like The Incredible Machine on DOS. But the question I wanted to ask was, what do you guys think of gamification in schools? Not necessarily directly playing video games to learn, but things like bringing in achievement systems or quote-unquote leveling systems and seeing how those can be applied to incentivize students to perform in certain ways.
Who wants to handle that?
Yeah, it's a really it's become a real issue in educational, formal, and informal environments. So everyone is it's really coming out of business world where so-called gamification, where they're adding very sort of light game mechanics and then achievement systems.
to whether it's your interaction with Starbucks as a brand, all the way over to sort of university environments, et cetera. And, you know, when it's done well, I think that you can end up with some really compelling, sticky, very engaging mechanics. You know, as Kurt had said, games are really this architecture for engagement. So you can take something mundane and you can turn it into something that's far more compelling by adding some mechanics that help you set goals, help you reach those goals, close the feedback loop in certain ways. Now, all that said, you know, I can point to a lot of examples that are just really not good examples of how it gets implemented, right? So, you know, having a card that gives me, you know, a star for every time I spend $10 at my local, butcher shop or whatever, and then on the 10th one I get, some sort of free kind of good, really isn't what I would call a game mechanic. It's really just an incentive system to keep your customers. I'm sorry.
No, in fact, I think that was Drew trying to jump in, but we actually have news coming up anyway. So let's put a hold on our conversation for just 5 minutes as we check NPR News and Wisconsin Public Radio News. And then we will continue exploring the educational promise of video games and welcoming your questions and experiences at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are talking about the educational role of video games. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's coming up on 6:37 on this Wednesday, December 18th. We are talking with two guests about how video games can help us learn and how they are being used in classrooms, and we're welcoming your questions, concerns, and experiences. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guests are Constance Steinkuhler, Associate Professor in Digital Media at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, co-director of the Games Learning Society Center, and Kurt Squire, Professor of Digital Media in the Department of Curriculum Instruction at UW-Madison and co-director of the Games Learning Society Center in the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery. We were talking just before news. A caller wanted to know what you thought of the gamification of the classroom. And I guess I need to understand exactly what does that mean, the gamification of the classroom?
Well, gamification in general is the idea of using game-like structures and so things like leveling up. So, you know, giving you like a level, you know, the more you do and the more you achieve, you get up, say, a level, or badges, which in a shorthand are not horribly different than things like Girl Scout badges or Cub Scout badges, as markers of success. And so games like World of Warcraft, we were talking about earlier, have all kinds of these things. So when you do a mission or you do something that's a particularly interesting achievement, the developers will give you sort of a badge. And these systems have become really popular in the business sector because they can build things like brand loyalty. And they're being applied to classrooms. Now, they can be done, what Constance was saying, they can be done very well at times, you know, if they're really applied with some nuance. So we studied some colleagues, for example, at RIT, the Rochester Institute for Technology, who did a really nice job creating badges that were meant meant to help learning. As an example, they made a badge or an achievement that you could only get if like 95% of the freshman class passed their kind of first exam. And the reason they did this is they knew that if they made an achievement or say a badge that required the whole group to do well, that it might cause, or they hypothesized it might cause study groups and get people to band together. And that's what happened. So people initially said, oh, we want to get that badge. So they started making study groups and kind of working together much more than they had in the past. And actually the grades were higher that semester than in the past. But you also can do it in a way kind of poorly that undermines motivation. So we know a lot from earlier research on, you know, things like gold stars and so on, where you can do this in a way that decreases people's intrinsic motivation, their interest in learning, which ultimately ends up being in some ways the most mm-hmm. powerful predictor of learning, and so that you can do more harm than good if you don't implement it well. But there, it's a, kind of a rapidly evolving area, and Constance and I both, and this is not an ad, but we both got those little kind of Fitbit wearable computer things that track your count, your steps and your exercise. And to me, that's an interesting example of how you're using kind of game-like structures of just, say, counting how well you're doing and give you an achievement mm-hmm. if you do well. And it can actually encourage you to be more healthy and do more exercise.
Well, we noticed on your website that games like Minecraft are being used to teach school subjects like ecology and chemistry and physics. And I want to give our listeners an idea of how that works.
Yeah, so Constance and I are both also professors at the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery, as you mentioned. And some of the work that we do is working with scientists to develop and research games that it's really based on the research that we do. And I can get to something, we can get to Minecraft in a second. But we, part of what we do is really try to build games that are built around kind of cutting edge science ideas and ideas that we really think would be interesting to the public. And we have games, like there's one called Virulent that's out on the iTunes store. We have some that are free online that really anyone can play and are meant to help create kind of foster a public conversation, very consistent with the Wisconsin idea, around kind of important science ideas and what they mean for the future of society. Constance, do you want to talk more about Minecraft, or should I tackle that one?
I'll go right ahead.
So Minecraft is an interesting example because, so for those who don't know it, it's something that you might think about as Legos, if they were a video game, so most people know, like, you know, Legos are kind of buildable bricks. And a Danish programmer, not just kind of on his own, came up with this game idea where you're building these, the whole world is made out of, say, Legos, and then there's zombies coming after you. And so what you have to do is kind of build a shelter, and then you've got to find food, and you can eventually build entire worlds. And the latest version even has something that's like electricity in it, so which is really kind of baffling. But you can build your own circuits, and people have built these elaborate structures, railroads and roller coasters. And what's so fascinating about Minecraft is that it's largely kind of peer-to-peer, so kids and players teaching other players, and it just completely has just run through the kind of early elementary grades. And I'm sure there's plenty of parents out there who are nodding their heads right now going, I know just what you're talking about, and other people who may be confused. But it's something like 44 million downloads. And what's interesting about it is that it's not an educational game. It wasn't designed to be. It was just designed to be fun. But a group of teachers have developed curriculum around it, and it's something I would never have bet on working. I thought, that's a crazy idea. It's never going to work. But they've actually built curriculum, particularly around things like the electricity, as a way to help introduce these concepts, and it's being used around the world for those purposes.
We have some other callers, so let's go to Carrie in Kenosha next. Hello, Carrie.
Hi. I have a 9-year-old son, and I don't allow him to have a video game machine in the house, but he does occasionally play computer games for learning. I guess my biggest concern about using video games for learning is that I feel that they take away from the greatest interactive, open-minded learning opportunity, which is life. In life, you know, you're not restricted to what tools you can use. The outcome is not restricted. I feel like in a video game, in a learning opportunity that way, you're not able to be as creative as you can be just experiencing life. And you know, our kids today are already spending so much time on screen. I don't see how it's beneficial to add this, into the learning environment at schools. I guess my main comment is how do these video games that serve as a learning opportunity, you know, what do they do for creativity?
Yeah, all right. Thanks very much, Carrie. Constance, you want to handle that?
Yeah, I really appreciate the comments because I think you raise a couple really interesting and important points and concerns. You know, I'm a parent of a 3-year-old and 6-year-old, well, 4-year-old today's his birthday.
You know, and the concerns that many of us have over screen time are very real. The number of hours that kids spend on screens is astronomical. I think the latest figures were something like about 11 and a half hours of media consumption that are packed into about 7.5 hours of screen time. This is per day, thanks to multitasking. So imagine that kids are now in front of a screen more hours of the day than they're in a classroom. And those are incredible and numbers that stop me in my tracks, right? On the other hand, you know, children are doing that because, I mean, adults are doing that, right? Most of our waking hours these days, for many of us, are spent in front of computers and other types of screen and media devices. So it's a very real trend. It's not going away. We're not going to roll back the state of play right now in terms of technology. But that said, thinking about, you know, how do you appropriately monitor and structure screen time so that it might be activity time, that it might be, you know, time that's engaging and sort of heads on, minds on, is a really important parenting question. And one of the tricks with games that I find in a very real way, it seems very mundane, but games are sort of hard to parent around because they require a lot of hours to get to know. And it's not like a rating system for movies where I can look and say, okay, I kind of know that Pixar films are appropriate for my children. It's much harder to sort of parent in this space and make sure that the media your children are choosing, whatever their age, and whatever their developmental level, are appropriate for them. It's just difficult work. And I don't think that the industry has done a good enough job in helping us make good consumer decisions around that. But as far as the point of creativity in games, I think I actually have to push back on that some. I walked into games thinking the same thing, where games were really highly structured spaces, and at best something like mathematics, where you have a very well-defined problem and you're sort of drawing inferences off of a set of very limited choices or premises to begin with. And it turns out that the games that are on the market now are so very varied, and there's a wild disparity between something like a Candy Crush or a Tetris-type, very puzzle-focused game, all the way over to full 3D worlds for open exploration that are what you would call a sandbox, where kids are creating things like in Minecraft and sharing those things with one another. I guess every parent has to make their own choices, because in the end, I think parents know what's right for their children, and you know, no one else knows the way a parent does what's going to work. But, you know, in our household in my interactions with other teachers and parents, I will say that, you know, I would consider something like digital literacy the new 21st century literacy. I would even go so far as to say that data and coding is the new literacy of the 21st century, and then it borders on a civil rights issue, where if you don't understand the very logic of code or how to actually get through a universe that is now digital by fact, that you are running a risk of not being able to engage in ways that are powerful and, not being able to make choices that are in your own best interest in the long term. Again, because I do not think historically that we are going to roll the clocks back on digital worlds. I think that the real task becomes helping children make choices, where their use of media is engaging and is productive for them, and life-enhancing, and not a distraction from life. I got to say, I'm a parent, too, that, if my kids are sitting on the couch with too much iPad time, we turn iPads off and we go out in the universe, right? We go play in the snow. We do those things. And I would be very concerned if my child were making choices, my own children, where they weren't actively engaging in those things around them as well. I just think that media are part of that world now. And to be quite frank about it, I think that some of the games that I can point to are beautiful experiences that I think everyone, I think would be wonderful to have, and I want my children to have.
And we want your 4-year-old to have a happy birthday today.
Thank you.
That's wonderful. we'll follow up on that point after we take a short break, and we'll continue taking your questions and your comments about video gaming and the positive and the negative impact of video game playing. Are you into gaming? Are you the parent of children who love playing video games? What questions do you have? What experiences have you had? Do you feel that there is an educational role for video games? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's coming up on 8 minutes before 7 o'clock on this Wednesday, December 18th. We are talking with two guests about video games and learning. We are talking with Constance Steinkuhler, who is an associate professor in digital media at the UW-Madison, co-director of the Games Learning Society Center, or GLS, and Kurt Squire, who's a professor of digital media in the Department of Curriculum Instruction at UW-Madison, also co-director of the GLS. And we're welcoming your questions about the benefits, the educational benefits of video games. And if you have concerns about the negative impacts of video games, we welcome those as well at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I know that we've done programs before on the negative impacts of video gaming, including violent video games like Grand Theft Auto. What are the effects of such violent games, Kurt or Constance?
Constance, you want to go ahead?
Yeah, and the reason that Kurt's t-balling this to me was that I was involved in... the vice, I worked with the vice president's office, and the vice president himself on, setting up meetings with industry to deal with issues of gun violence in the state after some of the tragedies that we faced. Looking at what is the role of violent media in that equation. I mean, I don't know any of us that aren't concerned with the amount of gun violence, and its presence among youth. I mean, there's no way around this. The games industry has not helped themselves. They tend to, they're a little bit cavalier at times around, their media production and the focus on, military games and, first person shooter games, et cetera, and the big ads that come up during sports events, et cetera, can really leave you with this impression that the games industry is, a lot of shooting and blood and gore. And there certainly are titles that are of that ilk, right? The hidden truth, though, is that number one, there are a wide variety of games and that the overwhelming majority of games are not first-person shooters or violent. They are E for Everyone or E10, so 10 years and up, or for teens, so that you have this like really broad swath of different genres of games. So to talk about games and violence is tough because we're really talking about this minor segment of the games industry that are the violent games, right? And when it comes to those, the short version is that there is no causal evidence. There's not even very good correlational evidence for youth violence in games. I know that comment is going to get me in trouble because there's a lot of interest in claiming that there are, but if you look at meta-analyses, it's not there. Now, to say that we have no evidence to support a causal claim there does not mean that the games industry gets out of the problem, that they have a real PR problem here. And by that I mean that, the games industry, they may not be part of the problem of violence in America, but they certainly could be part of the solution. You don't see them stepping up in the way that you might see Hollywood or other organizations stepping up or other sort of sectors of the industry stepping up. And by that, I mean things like improve your rating system, make it less easy for a kid under 18 or under 16 to get their hands on media that are not age appropriate, do work to enable parents to make better consumer choices that reflect their values of their families, because right now that's really tough to do unless you're willing to invest a lot of time catching up on what's Madden versus what's Counter-Strike, right?
Yeah. Let me, because we're running somewhat short on time here, any advice for parents who would like to have their kids benefit from the positive effects of video game playing and the learning opportunities, but wish to shield them from any of the negative effects?
I think the biggest one is to build on what Constance was saying earlier, for those who are here, about game playing as an activity, is to really try to engage with them and around them to what extent you can. So, how you play games and how you leverage gameplay, say, to build on kids or people's interests and then extend them into new kinds of activities that go beyond the game is really, I think, where they are most powerful. So if it's something like Minecraft, say playing with them, understanding why they're interested, and then using that as a vehicle toward either design or programming. If it's a historical game that they're interested in, using that as a way to build, say, interest in history, and then turning that into reading books, going to museums, traveling, and things like that. So I think that the real big thing is playing with them and then trying to understand where they're hooked into things and then trying to use that as a springboard into new kinds of learning activities.
Yeah. So should kids concentrate on games that are designed to teach, or can they benefit just from recreational games as well?
Oh, recreational games as well. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, you'd be amazed at how much problem solving and complex cognition goes into most entertainment games. But, you know, the truth as far as parent choices go are that, two things. First, it's picking the right media. And then second, it's really sitting there and playing with them and talking with them about it. When I first got into media, rather than designing these little worlds online that no one wanted to go to, when I first started studying commercial media, there really was nothing on games. So instead, I did this deep dive into television and looking at the literature on children's development and children's television. And the one big pattern you find that come out of the studies are that, you know, what's on the TV screen, whether it's, you know, Hill Street Blues versus Sesame Street. That's important, but it's equally, if not more important, what conversation is happening on the couch. So it's amazing what kind of impact you can have by simply asking a kid the most basic questions like, well, what do you think about that? Right? And getting them to talk and reflect on it. And that is probably, I would say, the single most important parenting decision you can make is to actually be there with them in some way, engaging them in conversation and dialogue around their video game play. Mm-hmm. Know what they're playing, make sure it's appropriate to your child and your values, but then you have to engage them in a conversation. Yeah. You have to engage them.
I wish we had more time for the conversation. I'm going to have to brush up on my digital skills. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you. We're big fans of the show.
Thanks a lot for being here. Constance Stein-Kuhler and Kurt Squire. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.